When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. My novel, Insatiable, one of Waterstone's best books of 2021, is now available to pre-order in paperback. Coming in February, you can get an exclusive special edition from Waterstone's with extra chapters and sprayed edges. Insatiable is also one of Apple's 12 best audiobooks of 2021. Thank you so much to the brilliant Charlie Clive, who narrated it so beautifully. Check it out on Apple and wherever else you get audiobooks from, and hear Charlie bringing Violet to life. Waterstones also have exclusive signed copies of my new novel, Careering, which is coming in March, and it's available for Your Book listeners to pre-order. Now, on to today's guest, Miranda Cowley Heller. We're here to celebrate Miranda's stunning debut, The Paper Palace, a story of first love and family secrets. It's been one of the year's smash hits. If you loved it, you're in brilliant company, so do Meg Wolitzer and William Boyd. We talked about the importance of endings, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and the filthy Victorian gentleman stories. I don't want to give anything away, but The Paper Palace has a sort of fabulously ambiguous ending, and you really are not sure how it's going to go, or even as a reader how you want it to go, which I loved. And I was wondering about other books that you've read where you had that same a feeling at the end where maybe things weren't resolved as you expected or resolved at all.
It's so interesting because in my mind, the ending wasn't ambiguous at all. I thought it was overly clear. And so it's been so fascinating at my end that all these people are saying, I want to discuss the end. I don't know what she did. And, you know, what I realized going back was that when I went back and read the line that was so obvious to me, it could be scanned in two directions. And I think you bring to it what you want. But I say that because I have a hatred of books that have completely, like, that don't give you the end.
Oh.
I mean, not, okay, hatred is probably too strong a word.
No, we like extreme emotions.
I feel like it was like a 80s and 90s trope. Like, it's too conservative to actually tell you the end of the story, right? You know, I love a film or a book that tells you the whole story, right? That having been said, for example, at the end of Normal People, which you think, well, maybe in the future, and yes and no, and you're not quite sure what's going to happen to these two people, I think that's one that I was so upset and sad at the end of it, I think that's one that I sort of liked because the ambiguity gave me a little bit of like a chink of hope.
Because that book is so character-led, and I think everyone feels so extremely and intensely about Marianne and Connor, and maybe their utter, like, you know, full 5D humanness. It's like, you know, with your friends, you would never expect your friends to say, well, this is exactly how my life's going to pan out. Bye!
Yeah.
And so perhaps it feels more tactile in that way. Have you read... I love Laurie Colwyn a lot, and I talk about her far too much on this podcast, but I'm a big fangirl. Family Happiness, which kind of disappointed me, and it's
I mean, I loved it. I really loved the experience of reading it, and I loved those people. And it's actually thematically not a million miles away from the Paper Palace, in that it is about the intensity of, you know, love and infidelity and people you really care for and root for, not necessarily doing the right thing by their spouses in a, I don't know, legal, moral, biblical sense, but you absolutely get it. And that just kind of tails off in a very lifelike way. And I think Colwyn is a very lifelike writer, and she shies away from the neat. But maybe, you know, she was writing in the 80s and 90s, delivering all those tropes when it felt fresh and new.
It did. I mean, at the beginning, it did. It felt, I think it felt brave in a way at the beginning. And then I just think, but when I want to read a comfort book, I want it to be Pride and Prejudice. I want everything. I want the kiss. I want the yes. I want the, you know,
so let's talk about Pride and Prejudice. When did you read it first? When did you meet it?
Oh my gosh. When I was 11, I think I read it
first. I think that's the perfect age.
And then I've reread it so many times I would lose count. It's one of my, I read it when I was in the hospital in labor. I took it on my honeymoon. It's my thing when I'm feeling like I need. Well, and this is precisely speaks to what we're discussing about endings. Mm. A sense of like happiness, completion, and safety in a way. I mean, that's just all apart from the writing itself, obviously, and all of her books, but that one in particular.
Does it feel the way it felt the first time every time, or has your relationship with the Bennetts changed?
It feels the same. And there's so many books that I don't have that experience with, that I read when I was young, in my teens or whatever, and that I had such passion for. And then I decided, oh, I'll go back, you know, decades later. And it just didn't do it for me at all. It was a different book. And I think, you know, there's a bunch of books like that that I had that experience with, including P.S. The Great Gatsby, which I got so irritated by the end. I was like, no, whoa. You know, I mean, and I've read it many, many, many times in my teens and, you know, but I think that, or my theory anyway, is that when we're younger, our imaginations are so vivid that we fill in all the blanks.
Mm.
So if the prose or the story is spare, we imagine and remember a much richer, almost sort of filmic world in our head. And then as an adult, I go back and I read certain books and I think it's so interesting. And I like the unsaid in writing, but it's so interesting sometimes how much sparer something is, or depressing in that case.
And I think Gatsby especially sometimes, you know, I've not read it in a long time. I love it, but it kind of almost feels like YA, or a little bit like Pride and Prejudice, but in an entirely different way, when you are so full of passion and energy and imagining, and whatever you choose, as long as you have chosen it, you're going to have such an intense relationship with it. And you just love the romance of it. And all you want I definitely remember as a young girl who was convinced like no one would love her or want her ever, the idea of just like Gatsby just, look, the length he's gone to for Daisy. Like, yes, please, sign me up. I tried to read Tender as the Night every year. I've not read it this year. I don't know if it felt too weird to go back amidst all the other weirdness. My first memory of that was that it is so passionate and intense and subtle. And I remember it feeling really sort of glamorous and luscious. And then going back and being like, this is a horrible book. Dick's the most mediocre character of all time. What was I thinking?
Yeah, well, that's sort of, I think when, you know, reading Gatsby, as you say, as a teenager, that it was so romantic. And then, of course, our point of view changes as well. And then I, you know, and it's just a sort of nasty social commentary with a really depressing ending. Mm. But anyway, and yet that last paragraph is profound, you know, obviously. And I had that experience with one of my favorite books of my whole life was Mary Renault's The King Must Die, which I also read when I was 11, which seems very strange to me. But and it was because it was assigned reading in my class in fifth grade. And I don't know if you've read
I don't know the book. Tell me about it.
Well, Mary Renault wrote The King Must Die and The Bull from the Sea, and they're both like Circe, that world, and the ancient world. It's the story of Theseus and going to Crete and the bull dancers and Knossos and this young man in his journey. And it's an incredible story. It's very adult, though. So I don't know why I had been assigned it. I mean, really, it's the kind of book that... Anyway. But for me, it was one of the most profoundly rich stories. And I remember these snakes and these sacks and these things, and landscape of Greece and Crete. And it actually changed my life because I decided after reading it that I wanted to be an archaeologist. And an underwater archaeologist, because half of Crete had gone under the water, and I thought, well, we can discover all of these treasures. And I mean, when I went to university, I went in as an archaeology major, and I soon realized I didn't want to be an archaeologist. But anyway, so that's how
was
much
that as like a slow dawning, or was there a day where you thought, oh, this is not what I thought it was?
The archaeology or the. the archaeology is one. Just to finish that, I reread *The King Must Die*, and it was so blank. I mean, it was so fill in the blank. I was like, where is the story though that I read? I couldn't find it. Archaeology. There were a few things. I had my dream was to be, as I say, an underwater archaeologist in Greece, off of Crete. And a couple of things happened. One was that I saw Jaws. And I became absolutely terrified of swimming in deep water and terrified of sharks when I was, so it must have been in my mid-teens. And then I went, I still persisted in my dream. And all it was taking little brushes and little bits of pottery and going, in a darkened room. And I think that was when I decided that wasn't what I was going to do. And I switched to literature.
What did you read when you were studying? Is there anything that you fell in love with? Luckily, nothing there put you off.
No, I did. I did a degree in a department called History and Lit, and I ended up doing American. I started out thinking I was going to do British and American, and you sort of had to go in with a bit of a reading list, sort of leading to your thesis, which is more, I think, sort of the British way of doing university than actually the American. And I wrote my thesis on three novels, which included To Kill a Mockingbird, which is another one of my childhood books that I think really informed for me. Young Dill was very, informative for me, for young Jonas. So I read a lot of American literature from the sort of 20s and 30s and that whole group of expats. So I was reading, the Hemingways and the Faulkners and all that stuff. Robert Penn Warren. I mean, there was a lot of sort of literature that was quite heavy, Sister Carrie, Theodore Dreiser, not so fun, but for me anyway,
And there must be so many books in that period, because I'm really fascinated by the idea, because there's lots of American literature that I love and I studied it a little, but I think the gaps in my knowledge must be enormous. And I'm sure that, American scholars and on the sort of the American syllabus, there are so many brilliant books that here we just, have forgotten or haven't got to because of that gap, the shared language. And yet there's still, a little bit of inconsistency.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that sort of the Southern Gothic writers of that time, and then of course a lot of these writers are rapidly going out of style at the moment. But Faulkner, who's amazing, I think, and Eudora Welty and Carson McCullers and all of these amazing female writers, strong women writers from...
I came so late to Carson McCullers and I couldn't quite believe that I didn't have those books earlier.
How old were you when you read it?
Oh God, I was in my early 30s.
Oh, you're kidding. I think I read that around the same time as I read Pride and Prejudice.
Because it's so... I think that worldview... And it's not like To Kill a Mockingbird, which I adore, which is very much about powerful people using that power for good, holding you at arm's length from the people without power and without privilege. And Carson McCullers is just so devastatingly, heartbreakingly vulnerable. And you see how everyone has nothing and she really brings you to it.
Yeah, definitely. And I, well, and just the, that a character, a young girl, you know, that you can relate to in that way, but it's a, such a serious and an amazing book. And to that point, I mean, I wrote my thesis on Uncle Tom's Cabin, Huck Finn, and To Kill a Mockingbird, examining the children's points of view in all these books that dealt with race in when they weren't sort of allowed, when adults weren't allowed to up until sort of To Kill a Mockingbird, voice, or, you know, white adults weren't supposed to be voicing, you know, the right opinion, the correct opinion, and but the children did. And so I wrote it about the children and you know, how, well, you know, all the obvious things, but one would say, I think, say, well, it doesn't matter what color, race, religion, you know, it was absolutely just inclusive and obviously obvious to them. There's no, you know.
And I think that we still need to discuss that in contemporary literature. I'm at the moment and guiding me through my sleepless nights, I'm rereading American Wife, and that sort of the bits of the mid-century that are captured. And again, it's a conversation about privilege and who has it and who doesn't. And that we, that period of recent history where there was still so much division, there is still so much division now, but
yeah, there's still way too much division now. but in the times before one was even allowed to sort of acknowledge that, I suppose. I mean, one was. But in America, obviously, race was and always has been.
That you couldn't be openly critical of the racism, even, that there had to be sort of ways and means of skirting around it. So I get the impression that you have always been a reader and someone who grew up with books and reaching for books. Were there any books that you had to kind of, you know, sneak? Was there anything that was like passed around school or...
Yeah, not passed around school. There was a book, a sort of basically Victorian pornography that friends found when they were little on their parents' bookshelf. It was this memoirs of a Victorian gentleman called My Secret Life. I don't know if you know the book, but...
I don't.
It's it was a... banned. I mean, it was one of those things you'd go into the library and it was under the glass case, like you're not allowed to take it and read it because it's, you know, pretty seriously horrifying. But it was, you know, it's a true story. I mean, it's this, they found this manuscript and we know it's some famous person from the period, but they don't tell you who the name is not ever.
And it's authentic. It's not someone who wanted to write porn in the 50s. He sort of pretended it.
No. This was his journals about, you know, having sex with the maids or there's a lot of rapey stuff. There's a lot, I mean, it's really quite dirty, but, and I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about any of these things on air.
No, yeah, I think it's, absolutely.
Well, I just always laugh when I think back because it's sort of the first porn that, and we sat in a circle of kids after they found it, we were out in the country, and would read these passages in like a state of absolute fascination because we didn't know the difference yet between really sort of Victorian porn or whatever, and, you know, it's him peeping through, you know, peepholes that are built into houses to watch, you know, the maids washing themselves, or, you know, it's all that kind of stuff. Really horrifying when you think about it. The tone is almost like the sort of the, you know,
Jack the Ripper,
yeah. That's almost the tone. That's how dark it feels. But I always remembered this one line because I had to go look it up, which was, he's having sex with some girl, I don't even know. And he said, and then I came into her libation. And I was like, oh, and like that was my earliest like sex line. Like came into her libation. And I just think that must have shaped me in some strange way.
That's magnificent. Because I always thought a libation was like something to drink.
Well,
but so do excuse
maybe
me.
Maybe he did.
Pass me that lemonade. I will never, ever, ever be able to get that out of my head now.
Anyway, so that was that one, I think. Yeah.
That it's so interesting, isn't it? That, and I think in a way, this is, you know, part of the problem that we have, that, not that I'm not, you know, saying that, you know, everything should be porn and porn should be for everyone, but there's maybe something in that. But also, it does, because I, you know, and everyone I know had similar finding weird, creepy, hidden things as, you know, young girls and young women, and it shaping you, and you thinking this sort of very aggressive, sort of problematic, like male view is sort of, is normal. And also this world where sex is sort of entirely heteronormative and men are kind of taking it to where they can and stealing it. And this idea that women have to pretend that, you know, they don't want it, it's sort of all against their will. I don't think that's helping anyone. And I think even in a liberal period, we've got people who are, you know, making art and writing whose erotic imaginations were shaped by Victorian gentlemen or his counterparts.
Or romance by Jane Austen. I mean, you know, when she's refusing, when Elizabeth Bennet is refusing her cousin's, you know, proposal of marriage, and he says, in essence, oh, no, that's what all women do. And you always say no, but you really want it. Basically, is that in essence what he's saying? You know, in a Jane Austen novel, that's the assumption, is that, you know, we protest and we say no, but really it means yes. Yeah, that's something that sort of fascinates me, the way these things actually sort of continue to translate.
Mm. So we've talked about rereading and about Pride and Prejudice. I wonder, are there any books, and there might not be, because if you've not really loved something first time around, why would you go again? But is there anything that you have not enjoyed or struggled with and then returned to and really connected with?
Huh. Oh, that's really interesting. Yes, and I put a, there's a nod to it in the novel, which is Middlemarch.
Ah! The improving book. Ways to be a better person.
I tried, you know, and I would try, and I just couldn't. I don't know why. I just didn't get the humor until I was so much older, and it's so funny, actually, the depth of irony and actually sort of criticism of the characters in the prose. But I didn't get that at all when I was younger, and I tried 10 times.
I mean, I find that hugely comforting. I've never tried. I've always wanted to, and been so daunted by it.
Yes, I know the feeling. But it is very interesting how it's just such witty social commentary, and that is so interesting now, you know, to me. Anyway, so yeah, that's one.
But I think there are a lot of writers, you know, older writers, who we talk about with such reverence, and no one ever tells you they're funny.
Right, well, exactly. I mean, yeah, you wouldn't think of Middlemarch as funny, but in fact it is. It's very tongue-in-cheek, in fact, her point of view. So yeah, that was a big surprise to me when I finally figured that out. But it took a while. And I think the other, you know, book, not that I didn't like, but we were talking about Jane Austen, and for some reason the other sort of book I go back to over and over again is Lord of the Rings. And I read that when I was at a very formative moment. Parents were divorced, and I was getting on a bus on a trip alone, and I was leaving him behind, and he ran into a bookshop and he said, read this, as I was quite nervous about going on this trip. I think I was probably 13. And I got on the bus, and I got off the bus something like 7 hours later, and I was just, I had never even looked up. And so that trilogy, when we were talking earlier about stories that have endings, stories that are full-fledged, as it were, I think that is, those are the kind of books that I loved as a child, really.
Because that's so immersive, isn't it? And that experience you described of being on that bus, and I can absolutely understand you wanting to really be in another world that does not resemble the existing one. And if any book is going to do that job, it's Lord of the Rings.
Right, yeah, absolutely. And just the imagination, that sort of the depth of the imaginary world, you know, I love that. It just spoke to me. But I think I also started out early reading a lot of dark fairy tales when I was young. I don't know if you have here all those colored fairy tale books. They're an amazing set of books that are all of these old, old fairy tales, and they're very dark. And I sort of read that as a child.
So these like Brothers Grimm style stories or something else? Because I can't think of a sort of, I can't quite visualise what they are, but I don't know if we have an equivalent.
I'm so surprised you didn't, because, or maybe you did, but before your time, as it were, because they were paperbacks and they were illustrated with the original illustrations. So they must have been, they certainly weren't American, and each one was a different color. So somebody loved the red book and someone loved the olive one, and there was the brown. The sort of like East of the Sun and West of the Moon, a lot of very sort of Germanic or Norse feeling tales, the prodigal son type of stories, a lot of kind of Beauty and the Beast type of stories as well, that kind of thing.
So what was your favourite? What colour was it?
Brown, weirdly.
And what were those stories? Can you remember what they were called or what happened?
The different stories?
Yeah.
There were so many that it was... They're just every fairy tale that you might have heard, from the sort of Cinderella to whatever, but they were the sort of original versions.
Ah.
Not the kind of... not the processed food version, so to speak.
Because like Hansel and Gretel, and I love the idea of the gingerbread cottage, but my understanding of that story is so basic, and I get it mixed up, I think, with the Billy Goat's Gruff, which I loved that as well, and like the layers of deception. But there must be so many things, you know, just like their walk through the woods and all of those, you know, children being sent out into the woods. Well, this is a very simplistic theory, and I've not really thought it through, but I mean, something I love, and it's so sad and so brilliant in The Paper Palace. And it made me think, I don't know if it's non-fiction, it's a bit by Ada Calhoun, former guest of the podcast, pal of mine, called Why We Don't Sleep or Why We Can't Sleep. And it's about sort of Gen X women, but about that parenting in the 70s and that sort of the ice housey, like, off you go, kids, we've got divorces to get through, you know, we'll see you at dinner, here are the keys.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are so many gothic tales about children being sent away into the woods and getting lost in the woods and neglectful parents, and whether all these like 70s parents were like, yeah, sure, that's our textbook. Have that, kids.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, I've been working on the book was sold to HBO as a miniseries, and because I have to come up with a lot of new, tons of new material and tons of new dialogue, just funny that this came up, I hadn't thought about it, but there's a whole very angry conversation between adult Elle and her father, where he says something about a grim fairy tale, and she says it's, you know, Grimm's, and goes on about a whole thing about the darkness of the divorce and his wife, and it's quite a funny scene, but it's absolutely that. It's Hansel, she talks about Hansel and Gretel. And those stories were in these books, but they were much darker. And I think in terms of the Paper Palace and that generation, I came from a family of divorce, and that's something that I really wanted to examine in the book.
Mm.
That generation of parents who were suddenly free. And I think the children became... I think it really affected how we grew up and how we viewed sexuality, possibly pushing us to a more conservative place, you know.
Mm.
When people are naked, your parents and other, your friends' parents are naked all the time around you, you know. On Cape Cod, all the parents were naked all the time, you know, in the summers. It was considered sort of slightly rude to wear a bathing suit on the beach, like on the public beach where we were. And they didn't want us to wear, my stepfather was a painter, and he set up a huge studio outside, and he would not. We weren't allowed to wear bathing suits when we were there because it would ruin the view, basically. You know, that kind of thing. And I think there's a freedom for the parents and a freedom for the children, in the sense that we were running free in the woods, and that was amazing. And at age 8 years old, we were swimming in the ocean unsupervised. Right, like forget helicopter parenting, like you say, no parenting. But also, and you know, the ice storm stuff. You know, but then there's also a kind of dark edge to that, in my memory anyway. Not just the horrible stepmothers or divorce or all of the things that entails, but that generation of parents, yeah.
I mean, I remember, you know, when I was quite a little kid, I've got lots of sisters, I've got five younger sisters, so I sort of felt, I think, old. I felt very aware of, you know, even when I was sort of young, I didn't feel like a kid because there were so many kids. And I remember having this really keen sense of, like, you know, privacy and wanting to lock doors and wanting to be clothed and wanting to be. And I think that when you take that away from a child, it's weird, isn't it? Because you're like, no, this is what's natural. And you're like, well, not necessarily. That impulse to protect yourself and your softest places and your vulnerability, maybe that's what's natural. But yeah, it makes so much sense that that's the generation whose children, you know, they wanted to be supervised and to keep them safe. And, you know, that's a very logical and sensible reaction to growing up.
Yeah, and I think also
in that way.
Sort of like, oh, I want to stay married kind of idea, you know. That, and then I think it's sort of swings and roundabouts, because then there's sort of more of a open divorcee era, you know, time period, and now my nieces and they're all having these huge weddings, you know, with big bachelorettes, and there's, you know, reveals, all these incredible pomp and circumstance around that feels very 1950s, actually.
Yeah.
Around weddings, and it's like a big, big performance.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
We'll be back with Miranda soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen The Incomplete Family Examiner by The Editors. This is extremely funny, astonishingly silly, and it brings me even more joy than a 1993 Beano annual. I promise so much laughter, and I think this is the perfect Christmas present for anyone who is a bit tricky and taciturn. It gets to the places other books can't reach. If they don't love it, they're not worthy of proper presents, and you should just get them a voucher next year. The Incomplete Family Examiner is published by Unbound, and it's available from all book retailers. Now, back to Miranda.
Are there any love stories or weddings in books that you enjoy? Because like, a good book wedding is just great fun.
of course, weirdly, my mind immediately went to The Godfather.
of course!
Which also
hard to argue with that
or sex scenes. But my brain goes then secondly to one of my very favorite books at age five, called The Rabbit's Wedding, which is a children's little beautiful illustrated children's book. I don't know if you ever had it, about a black bunny and a white bunny who fall in love and get married among the daisies. And that was, I loved that book as a little child. It was like a simple fairy tale. I do love romantic books in general, you know, I think quite sort of obviously. I mean, it's funny because all the, you know, keep coming back to Jane Austen, but Persuasion was one of my also all-time favorite novels as a child, because, and even now, for the exact same thing, that sort of the arc of the romance that finally happens and you want it to and it should, and then, you know, they're going to get married.
And it's an incredible thing, isn't it, when you know it will happen. You can trust that in a book. You know the love story is going to be satisfying. But also, there's a bit of you that is that you're engaged enough and nerves, even if you've read it 14 times before, you're still, is this definitely going to be, you're still reaching for them.
Oh, completely. You're invested. By the way, I do that with certain movies. I just have to re-queue up certain moments. I mean, you know, not just Pride and Prejudice or Far from the Madding Crowd, the most recent one. You just go back to that kiss. It just embodies everything one dreamt about or dreams about, I think, in a way.
Like what movies?
The remake of Far from the Madding Crowd, and the both Pride and Prejudice, I would say, but also, okay, this is a lo-fi, but the Twilight movies and books. I know, but I really liked them, and I thought because I had a theory, but because they were written by a Mormon, the point of view of people who cannot kiss.
Mm. Right?
She was able to sustain, you know, non-sex, basically, throughout several volumes of books. I mean, of course, then they can.
Yeah. The pet breaks.
But I really enjoyed that one. I thought, oh, good. I thought that, you know, my theory was that women of a certain age, more married or whatever, or a bit older, loved it, and then young girls loved it, and I think it's because it captured the moment before that kiss, that suspended moment of incredible romance, just kept it in the air like that. And I think for young girls, it's like what they haven't experienced or dreaming about, say, and for women like me, I'll talk for myself, it was like the moment I knew I would never have again. So I wanted to go back and revisit it, you know, that sort of the intake of breath,
yeah,
before the kiss, right?
Waiting and the hoping and the pacing. So when the first movie came out, my first ever job was at a teen magazine called Bliss, which I guess is like 17. I think those realizing what those books and what those films meant to those, you know, young people who were dreaming of romance and weren't ready for it yet, but it was all they hoped and wanted and waited for. Like, my favourite book of all time is The Pursuit of Love by Nancy Mitford. I don't know if you know.
I do know, and I did also see the miniseries.
Oh, the recent one.
The recent
with
one.
Dominic
West is, yes, in it, and it's, what's her name, the one he had the thing with?
Yes, yes. Linda getting off with Uncle Matthew, not ideal. But I remember all of those bits where they're in Hans' cupboard, and Linda and Fanny, they're in love with love. And Fanny has this crush on this farmer that she's never met, and she's just seen him from like miles away on film, be like, he will do all of my adolescent hopes and dreams, and yet I've got so much yearning to pin on someone, and I'm pinning on that guy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those crushes were the best and the worst crushes, right?
And I think it's almost so much fun. You don't need your crush to participate sometimes. You can just be, you know, there enjoying it.
Yeah, and I love those girls too, by the way. Yeah, completely.
They are fantastic. So who were your, are there any book crushes we haven't talked about? Any heroes? And they don't have to wear breeches, but that is a bonus.
It's a huge bonus, obviously. But what I was going to say was that I go back to children's books a lot. Certain children's books. I actually reread the same way, probably from the same period, a little earlier, you know. I don't know if you guys ever read the sort of the Wolves of Willoughby Chase.
Yes.
All the Joan Aiken books.
A Necklace of Raindrops.
And it's so, yes. And then, and all that was romance to me at that age, you know, the sort of Simon and the, you know, the two little girls, you know, obviously slightly in love with this boy who lives in the woods and, you know, so on. I mean, Last of the Mohicans. was not from that period, obviously, but I think that, of course, that character is fantastic.
Is that another book you read when you were...
Much older, I think, actually. You know what? I read when I was quite young, The Three Musketeers, and that was another crush. So everything seems to have, like, doubloons or pantaloons, whatever they're called. Yeah, that was a huge crush book.
If someone had a swoosh to buckle. But I wonder whether it kind of it frees your mind a bit to really fancy someone. There's that remove. If they're too of this world, you start thinking of all of the real things that might get in the way, and you can just fantasize in a much more open, sort of relaxed way when they are from the past. I've never read The Last of the Mohicans, and I don't think I've ever seen the film, which is something I have
If you haven't seen the film, it is the most romantic movie I can imagine. And there's a line, the main line from it has been reused by so many people. And in fact, reused in Twilight as well, you know, when Daniel Day-Lewis, and he goes, oh, he has to leave her, you know, trapped with, you know, about to be killed, and I will come back for you, you know, and of course does, but and it's the movie is so romantic. Highly recommend.
Well, I know what I'm doing this weekend. That's the opposite of I'll Never Let You Go, Jack, isn't it?
Yeah.
You talked about the Paper Palace being adapted to the screen, which I'm so excited about. And I know that, you know, you have worked in that world and brought so many incredible things to our screens. Are there any books you would love to make into either movies or series or anything that if I could give you an unlimited budget and you could cast anyone you liked, you'd go out and adapt?
Go out and adapt. Well, the the book that I have this weird desire to go out and adapt, which is is a children's book, but called The Witch of Blackbird Pond.
Oh, I don't know that.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's that same sort of agey thing as like Island of the Blue Dolphins, but anyway, it's set in Puritan Connecticut, and you know, it's about a young girl who comes from, who's been raised in Jamaica, English, and her parents die, and so she has to traverse the sea and arrives in this horribly cold, awful, sort of place where they're killing witches, you know, that whole time, and very sort of Nathaniel Hawthorne-y time. It's a really interesting story to me because it's also a romance, by the way, wonderful romance between her and one, and a boy who lives there, a man who lives there, young man. But it's, I haven't seen anything that I've loved set in that period of American history. It's such a strange, spare, sort of angry time, judgmental time period in this landscape where you're just settling and there are threats coming from the outside if you've just come over, and that sense of having to keep a totally controlled society, and then coming into it this colorful bird, basically, who doesn't understand and doesn't understand the strictures of that religion. And so it's this the clash of those worlds. But I was always really fascinated by the early American history of, you know, the Cotton Mather and the Puritan culture and how that came over, which was very different from the Pilgrims, right?
Yeah.
It's a whole other movement.
That sounds incredible. And like raising this community to be fearful and that sense of kind of always being threatened and pushing things out. Have you read, do you know A Little Princess by Frances Hodgson Burnett, who wrote The Secret Garden?
Hello.
I had a feeling it might be.
I've read that probably, I can't even think how many times, as well as The Secret Garden, which I reread as an adult, and it had this one passage that I actually reread to a friend on the top of a London bus a year ago. I said, you can't believe how profound this is. It's how I feel now as an adult in The Secret Garden. But A Little Princess, talk about the most romantic story. And even I loved Little Lord Fauntleroy, so I'm clearly a sucker for we haven't even gotten to Jane Eyre or, you know, Wuthering Heights or, you know, etc.
Oh, that, those, that.
Didn't you love those books?
Yes.
Oh.
That it's, I think, a little princess more than any, because I really loved the utter two-faced meanness of Miss Minchin and the way, and I think there are lots of people I've talked to who think that Sarah, she's just so obnoxiously pious and she takes it all so well, unlike Mary, who is sort of an out-and-out brat who learns not to be, but just the way, the glitter and glamour and the diamond mines, and then the opposite, the reversal of fortunes that she does so well. And I thought that was just incredible and the greatest thing. And it's that line where she talks to Becky about how wealth is nothing but an accident of birth. And I'm like, that line made me a socialist when I was 8.
Yeah, no, I love that book so much. And P.S., the book I've been describing, which is Blackbird Pond, is very, very similar.
That's she exactly comes with all what this I was...
wonderful life with, yeah, huge fancy life, and then she's orphaned and she becomes, and it's sort of Wolves of Willoughby Chase too. It's,
yeah,
these books, these orphaned rich kids who,
and you know, wicked grown-ups coming
wicked
in,
grown-ups, exactly.
But I think when you're describing that book, I got goosebumps, like, oh, that sounds like something I would really love.
Yeah. I always wanted to make, well, it's so funny, when I first got to Los Angeles and was working at HBO, I went out for lunch with an agent, and he kind of asked me the same question about, because I'd come from the book world, and I said, you know, what I've always wanted to make, and, you know, I'd quit my job in a heartbeat, is The Lord of the Rings. And he said, oh, that's so interesting. I have a director, and he wants to make it. And we all went out for lunch, and we talked about how we would do it and what we would do. And then he brought it back to the agency, and they said, nobody would go to see that movie. No one will go and see The Lord of the Rings. Are you kidding? It would be like going to see The Hobbit. And then, you know, oh, God.
Oh, dude.
I mean, but P.S., he made those movies very beautifully, I think. But it was really annoying.
Oh, that must have been so bittersweet to see it.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, God. I wonder if that person remembers saying those words.
It wasn't even just they would sit down in a conference room and say, oh, we've had these meetings, and it came back, you know, unilateral, nobody would ever go to that film. So so there's that.
Oh, hindsight is a hell of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think probably a lot of films may be being made that I don't know about, but another one is The King Must Die. That's another that I was describing to you, that I would love to make as a film, because then everything I saw in it when I read it when I was younger, all the imagination could be put up on its feet. And I know I think in a very visual way, or I write, I think, and think in a very visual way. And that probably has to do with my push away from the books where I went back and thought, really? You know.
But I feel like also if you made The King Must Die, you'd have the opportunity, you could be an underwater archaeologist, in a manner of speaking, sort of do it on your terms, how right. you imagined it would be. And you'd be, you know, living that life rather than, you know, not just scraping away
not
at
just scraping
bits
away.
Of pottery.
I mean, I think in a weird way, writing in archaeology in its sort of dreamy or, you know, romantic form, are quite similar because for me, the experience was, or the difference, let's put it that way, is that in the archaeologists are purposefully, you know, digging for something. And when I'm writing, I feel like as long as I stop looking for something, like I unearth it. So there's this kind of thing about kind of going under the surface, and things just come from nowhere, which is the first line of the novel, as it happens.
Oh, I love that. And I think about that all the time when I'm writing. The analogy I keep sort of working at is like, I just want to be alone on the seabed with this thing I'm trying to make, and I just want to see what's there, and I can't be in it if I'm above the surface and there's too much noise around me. But then I think, you know, often when, you know, when reading, or, you know, when you're sort of receptive, there are pearls and so many things where, well, it's like talking about Wolves of Willoughby Chase and Little Princess and The Secret Garden, and I can sort of feel those sticking, and that they're I think something's going to turn up in a not obvious way, and it's not like I'm going to write a character, you know, called Mary who's bad tempered and in India and
quite contrary.
Yes. But there's definitely something there, sort of thematic, if I leave it to brew for long enough.
Yeah. By the way, I did think about I was thinking about Outlander and Poldark.
Ooh.
When you were talking about novels that had male characters who one lusts after and then that are turned into.
Excellent. You know, strong choices. And did you come to the books first?
Yeah, with Outlander, you know. I mean, I read all these big. The Far Pavilions. I don't know if you ever read, which is set in India, and I must have been published in the 70s. Incredibly romantic. It was also made into a miniseries. And you know these sort of thick romantic books. I definitely read when I was, the Outlander series is one of those things. It's like Twilight. You just don't necessarily want to admit that you love it, but you know that kind of yummy, it's delicious.
And when you know there's lots, when you can really immerse yourself and feel like I've got so much book ahead of me, I've not got to ration this.
Yes,
I can just
exactly
immerse.
Exactly.
I could talk to you forever about books, which is why I'm mindful of, you know, that sadly I can't, and you've got a very busy schedule and lots to do, and I've got to be aware of the time. Are there any books that you haven't mentioned that you would like to talk about?
Yeah, I think Anthony Doerr's All the Light We Cannot See was a book I both loved and that kind of changed the direction of the Paper Palace.
Oh, interesting.
For me, when I got to the end of that novel and I realized what, in fact, the title meant as a metaphor, and also not as a metaphor, I was stunned by the notion, the beauty, the way he brought it all together. I mean, of course, I loved the book too. And it made me want to go back and really think about the Paper Palace and really stop and think about where it was going. And it really led me, without knowing it, toward the ending that the book has, where it's really a story about Elle. It's really not. It's a story about a woman's life and her trajectory, I think. And it's not, you know, yes, of course, there's two men and etc. But really, it's her journey and her journey to that particular moment where it's the place that's inside her. It's the metaphor of all the little pieces of paper crushed together that can still stand strong. And so that book, so All the Light We Cannot See, was definitely pretty instrumental while I was writing this, as I would say the other two books that really freed me up. One is just Ali Smith, but particularly Autumn, because I couldn't believe how free it was and how she went this way and that way and this way and that way, and you know, a kind of platonic love story between an ancient man in a coma and a young woman. It was like, whoa. And
I think she's a writer that we talk about in very sort of serious literary terms, and she's very good, and she's very good, but she's really funny, and no one ever says that.
Funny and just free. There's a freedom to where she'll go. That I went, it made me go, oh yeah, you can do that, Miranda, because this is my first book, you know, and I'm beginning, you question, you know.
It's feeling something dramatic must happen on page 112, and there's got to be this beat and this resolution and this.
Yeah. And then I think James Salter is somebody who was very influential to me as a writer, and his style of writing and the importance of dialogue. The importance of what's unsaid in dialogue, and also his descriptions of the natural world and how one gesture between two people tells you, oh, she hates her. A little teeny gesture, nothing, and you get the whole picture. And I saw he's somebody that, you know, Light Years was a book, I don't know if you've read it, but it's a wonderful novel.
Is he a sport and a pastime? I don't think I've read Light Years.
Which is horny.
Quite.
But
oh God, you're talking about romance, and I'm just lowering the tone again.
No. I think it was Sport and Pastime is a wonderful novel, but Light Years is, and it's about the period we were talking about, really. Well, more the 60s, early 60s, divorce and marriage and this kind of, it just creates a social world that is incredibly resonant.
I really want to read that. I think that's right up my alley.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah, it's not a big novelly novel, but there's a James Salter book I love that he wrote with his wife or partner, Kay. Which we're giving to friends as a wedding gift, and it's now out of print. So the only copy I was able to get hold of looks quite sad and sorry for itself, but it's called Life is Meals. Every single day of the year has an entry with it's mostly food, occasionally it's a person or a recipe, but so...
Wow, how funny that you have this. That's the book we
Let's see what it is today. Is it the 22nd today of the time of recording?
You'll love Light Years because the whole first section is preparing the dinner and the way that the wife prepares this dinner and every gesture of hers and the way the husband prepares it. And, it's like a dance.
That does sound gorgeous. 22nd of October. Today it's California wine.
How appropriate.
There is an immense variety and the choice can be bewildering. Which is true of books also.
That is definitely true of books also.
Huge thanks to Miranda. The Paper Palace is published by Viking and out now. If you haven't read it yet, it is a book you'll want to drop everything for. You can follow us at YBooked on social media, look out for book recommendations, words of wisdom from old guests and occasional shelfies. We love it when you share the podcast with your friends, and thank you so much to everyone who's left us a 5-star review. It helps other people to discover us and their favourite new books. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Miranda at acast.com/booked and check out her selection in our bookshop on bookshop.org. We'll be back next week. For now, I leave you with this from Raymond Carver. Writers don't need tricks or gimmicks or even necessarily to be the smartest fellows on the block. At the risk of appearing foolish, a writer sometimes needs to be able to just stand and gape at this or that thing, a sunset or an old shoe, in absolute and simple amazement. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.